Free FM.
Here you can be free.
Penn Jillette.
This is Penn Jillette on the big Free FM. That's PennRadio@gmail.com. PennRadio.com, PennRadio.com. If you want to send in a question or something, we have a very special Penn Jillette show today. I'm sitting with Michael Goudeau, and we have here one of the, well, we only know of two people now that have been on Bulls hit twice, and that is Paulie Klass's father, who was
Mark,
on the Talking
Klass,
the Dead
yeah.
show, Mark Klass, and was also on the
ESP,
Death Penalty show.
Yeah.
And then we have Patrick Moore, who was one of the founders of Greenpeace. Oh, that's not even true. Patrick Moore is here today. We're going to talk to him. But first, I have to say that that's not true. We want to be as accurate as you can. There's also a lot of naked people who are on a lot of shows. They were on a lot of shows because we like to get naked people into our politics on our show. And so we have the same naked people over and over again. In Vegas, there's like a pool of like 10 people who are naked. And you bring them in and you do different shows. And
it's
all
the glass time. Pool of naked people.
The glass pool of naked people. But we now have, and this is a big hero of mine. I guess since you're here, I'll have you say who the hell you are. One of the founders of Greenpeace.
Yeah, I was doing a PhD in ecology in Vancouver, where I'm from, in the late 60s, and became radicalized and became an environmentalist, and then joined the small committee of people. They were called the Don't Make a Wave Committee at that time, soon to become Greenpeace. And I was in the planning team and on the first voyage of Greenpeace against U.S. hydrogen bomb testing in Alaska in 1971. And that began a 15-year full-time career as an international director of Greenpeace. By the time I left in 1986, we had grown from a church basement in Vancouver to a group with 100 million U.S. coming in every year and offices in 21 countries. And I was flying all over the planet, setting up new offices, starting new campaigns, leading campaigns. I was on the Save the Whales voyages into the Pacific. 1975 was the first voyage, and then 76, 7, 8, and 9. So 5 years running, I was out on the North Pacific in the Greenpeace boat chasing the Soviet factory whaling fleet around and confronting them and getting in front of the harpoons and getting the type of footage that would go on national television and made Greenpeace famous and brought the Save the Whales movement into everyone's living room for the first time.
Everyone's living room, yeah. And what then you left Greenpeace in what, 86?
I left Greenpeace in 86 because I didn't like the way it was drifting. Basically what happened in the mid-80s, by that time, a majority of people agreed with us. We had become mainstream, whereas in the early 70s, we were a real fringe group, and a lot of people thought, these guys are protesting U.S. hydrogen bomb tests. They must be a bunch of commie pinkos. Then maybe they're on the Kremlin side.
But by 86, you were a bunch of commie pinkos.
Well, yeah, in the sense that the commie pinkos took over the organization is how I see it.
And,
it wasn't just that. It was also the extremism. You know, I think we have to differentiate between extremism and political leaning. Extremism, for example, would be a campaign to ban chlorine worldwide. That's got nothing to do with politics particularly, whether you're left or right.
Right.
Whereas the ultra-left element that came into the environmental movement was because world communism failed and a whole lot of peaceniks and political activists who didn't have a focus on nuclear war anymore moved into the environmental movement, bringing their neo-Marxism with them, learned to use green language in a very clever way to cloak agendas that are really more about anti-globalization and anti-capitalism than they are about science or ecology. Not that those aren't legitimate subjects, but I think it's misinformation to cloak anti-globalization and anti-capitalism in green language to make it appear as though it's an environmental issue. So those two things combined. The reason for the extremism was because now that a majority of people agreed with us, the only way, with all our reasonable positions, the only way to remain anti-establishment and confrontational, adversarial, was to adopt ever more extreme positions they eventually abandoned science and logic altogether in these zero tolerance policies.
Why do you think it moved in that direction? Why would an organization move away from logic? I mean, other than the fact that every organization in history has always moved away from logic.
Because the politicos, who are much better at power grabbing than a young ecologist like me, who is not a Machiavellian sort by nature, took it over. They worked really hard to do so. And before you knew it, the sort of eco-entrepreneurs and political activist types whose agenda is more about left-wing, right-wing politics than it is about science and ecology, which is where I'm centered, and I was one of five international directors for the last 7 years I was with Greenpeace, and I fought against the tendency to move into anti-science agendas, such as the ban chlorine worldwide. You know, and that is Greenpeace's position to this day, and it emerged in the mid-80s and was one of the reasons I left, because I couldn't hold that in me. As a person with a science background, I said, you guys, chlorine happens to be one of the elements in the periodic table. Like, I don't think that's in our jurisdiction, right? And I reminded them that, that about 75% of our medicines are based on chlorine chemistry. Adding chlorine to drinking water is the single biggest advance in public health in history. The best way to deliver that drinking water with a little chlorine in it to the general public is in a PVC polyvinyl chlorinated pipe.
And what would they say to those arguments?
They treated it as if there was minor exceptions or something, you know, when in fact they are central to civilization.
They're the whole argument. And weren't they successful in certain places in South America? Didn't they get chlorine pulled out of certain water supplies?
I don't know if Greenpeace is blamed for that, but it was certainly their policy that influenced the situation. I don't know if it was them directly, but yes, in Peru, they stopped chlorinating the water, and it wasn't long till there was a cholera epidemic.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, waterborne communicable diseases like typhoid and tetanus and cholera were rampant before the chlorinization of water started 100 years ago.
And those things are what I would call water pollution.
Yes, they certainly are. And, you know, that's why people only lived an average of 35 years 100 years ago, was largely because of waterborne diseases.
And what about, weren't they very involved? I know it starts with Rachel Carson with Silent Spring, but weren't they also really involved in the DDT stuff that brought malaria back big time in the third world?
The ban on DDT, Greenpeace is very active nowadays, but I wouldn't count them as in the beginning of that movement in any way. No, that was Rachel Carson. Actually, that was Bill Ruckelhaus as head of the Environmental Protection Agency in its early years. Mm-hmm. And it is now thought that really what that was his way or his people's way of establishing power, was the ability to ban a whole chemical that the chemical industry was manufacturing. And DDT at that point got labeled with being a really nasty compound, when in fact to this day there is no scientific proof that DDT is harmful to human beings, for one thing.
But very, very helpful to human beings. I mean, when they banned DDT, you had those malaria surges in India and Africa that were terrible.
Those continue to this day.
Yeah.
The activists have infiltrated the World Health Organization, and the World Health Organization, which is an international aid agency, donor agency, will not bring DDT into its malaria control program. So if you're in a poor country that can't afford to set your own agenda, you're not going to get DDT from World Health Organization, whereas South Africa, which is wealthy enough to be able to set its own policies on this, still uses DDT. Well, actually, they quit using it for a while, and malaria rates skyrocketed. They have since reduced them by 90% in the last few years. There's a whole Stop Malaria program going on. It's organized largely out of the Congress for Racial Equality, which is a mostly black but lots of white and other colored supporters based out of New York. And Paul Dreesen, I don't know if you know of him, he's very much fronting this. He wrote a book called Black Death is Green Money Black Death or something like that. It's about how the environmental movement's campaign against DDT is really one of the main causes of the 300 million or so people who get malaria every year, and the 1 to 3 million, mainly young and old people, who die of malaria every year. And this isn't about broadcast spraying. Like, Rachel Carson was upset about the fact that back then in agriculture, DDT was used as the primary insecticide, and it was sprayed broadcast over huge acreages of farmland, and it was being put directly into the environment. Now, there's still a lot of question about the thinning of the birds' eggshells. That was that was the hook that was used to ban DDT.
The last stuff I read said that probably wasn't true, the thinning of the eggshells.
Well, I don't even know. You know, I've read stuff back and forth on it. Some studies show that DDT actually caused the eggs to get thicker shells on them. Mm-hmm. It was a trumped up situation, what? As far as I can see. But using DDT for malaria control isn't about broadcasting over the whole countryside.
Right, it's just in the
inside the houses.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Actually, no, it's just inside the houses.
Oh, really?
If you just spray it on the walls inside your house, the mosquitoes don't come in. And Greenpeace and them say, well, they should be using bed nets that are impregnated with less toxic insecticides. Mm-hmm. The trouble is people don't use bed nets at dinner time.
Right.
And that's when the mosquitoes are worst, is just as you know, when the sun goes down, the mosquitoes come out, and that's when they're very worst. So it isn't effective to use bed nets. You're not going to wear a net over yourself while you're having dinner,
mm-hmm.
and or in the evening while you're sitting around before bed. And so, yes, it's effective to use a mosquito net while you're asleep, but it has to be augmented with some kind of insecticide or repellent in order to make sure the mosquitoes don't come into your
house.
Now,
who coined the term watermelon for the Greenpeace thing, for green on the outside, pink on the inside?
No idea, but it's reasonably relevant in some cases. I mean, there are a lot of environmentalists like myself who are not left-wing. I consider myself politically centrist. I'm a social liberal. I am a fiscal conservative. Mm-hmm. On the money side, I believe we should balance our books personally and nationally and all that. But I do not believe that that has a lot to do with ecology policy.
Now, what part of ecology, what part of the, are there any of the ideas and the things you fought for in early Greenpeace that you've now turned around on? Or has your ideology and your science remained pretty much the same and just the organization changed? Which ones have you changed? Did Greenpeace change or did you change?
Both changed, but to listen to Greenpeace, you'd think I wanted to start hydrogen bomb testing again and slaughter the last whale, you know.
Yes, well, that's what I'm asking.
In fact, I have not changed my position on any of the things I fought for in those early years, with one exception, and that is nuclear energy.
Mm-hmm.
And in retrospect, it's clear to me that the reason I was opposed to nuclear energy had a lot to do with the nuclear Holocaust scenario. The fact that we started by opposing nuclear testing because we believed that nuclear war would be the ultimate destruction of the environment as well as the destruction of civilization. In other words, green peace was meant to mean we're talking about green, the environment, and peace, humanity, and not destroying our civilization.
Were you on the board that came up with the name? Were you part of that discussion?
I was not there when it happened. It happened in a meeting a little bit earlier. It was just coined as I was joining the group. A carpenter named Bill Darnell, who was attending the meetings and was on the first voyage as well. That was sort of the end of his involvement. Most of the people who went on the first voyage, it was kind of a one-off for them, uh-huh. and they went back to their normal lives,
mm-hmm.
Whereas I remained for 15 years pretty well. I was the longest person that remained in Greenpeace after the first voyage by far. And it was coined. Back in those days, you remember you flash the peace sign when you say goodbye to somebody. So mm-hmm. at the end of a meeting, somebody said, peace, everybody. And Bill Darnell thought about it for a second and said, why don't we make it a green peace? And it was as simple as that. And it stuck.
It is great marketing. I mean, the Greenpeace people and the PETA people, you know, have so much money and such great marketing. It's I mean, the idea of coming up with the phrase Frankenfood. I mean, the battle was won.
Exactly.
When the guy came up with that. And
I love to talk about this because Frankenstein food or Frankenfood, then there's killer tomatoes,
right.
and there's Terminator seeds.
Yeah.
If you look at the derivation of all those metaphors, they come from scary Hollywood movies.
Exactly.
All three of them.
All of them. And the cloning debate, too.
Exactly.
I mean, all the cloning debate, I think, is nothing but science fiction.
It's pure fiction and fantasy. And the criticisms of genetically modified foods are based on fantasy just as much as those movies were.
Well, absolutely. And the fact is that all of our food is genetically modified, just not in that way. I mean, corn does not exist 2,000 years ago. I mean,
exactly. And the same goes for all of our crops.
All of it.
And our animals. I mean,
yeah.
there was no such thing as herds of cows roaming around
right.
in the Middle East. They looked a lot different than they do today,
right.
and they were actually capable of surviving in the wild.
And all that does, and what about wild chickens?
We need more of those.
And I'm not talking feral chickens. I'm talking pure wild chickens.
I work with aquaculture people. Salmon farming is a big deal in the world today. Like about 75-80% of all our fresh salmon comes from farms rather than the wild, which is good because the wild stocks can only take so much fishing pressure.
Right.
Matter of fact, they're under, you know, the Atlantic salmon is almost extinct because of overfishing. And yet the environmentalists like Greenpeace are against salmon farms, right?
Why?
Because they think wild fish is the only way to go. And I'm going like, you guys, it was 10,000 years ago when we moved from wild chickens and turkeys and pigs and cows into having farms to grow these animals. And yet they're against it.
Yeah, you know, those wild chickens tasted better.
I doubt it. I bet they were a little bit stringy. They probably didn't have very much flavor and certainly not much fat content. You know,
my age, I'm 51 years old. So my age was, we had ecology classes and really the ecology agenda in my high school. It was just about the exact right timing.
Exactly, just when it came in, because I'm 58, and when I was in high school, the word ecology did not exist.
Exactly.
As a matter of fact, an early Greenpeacer named Ben Metcalf, he was a CBC Canada radio broadcaster, very controversial figure, got purged out of the left-wing radio station for being too left-wing, and he bought 12 billboards in Vancouver in 1979 on prominent intersections, and the billboard simply said in big letters, ecology, look it up, you're involved. People had to look the word up.
Oh, yeah, it was amazing. But we, where I went to high school was right near the University of Massachusetts. So that was a very kind of hippie culture there. So they would, student teachers would come into my high school. And the ecology stuff, all that kind of, it was all mixed up from the very beginning to me. The whole hippie thing, the ecology thing.
Well, you
thing,
were way after Haight-Ashbury, like, right?
When right.
You
were in 68, I was 13.
Yeah, so Haight-Ashbury was happening when you were a young teenager.
Really important
See, I was in my 18, 19, 20 around there, and I lived in the part of Vancouver, which is basically Haight-Ashbury North, Kitsilano.
I completely took that whole point of view. You know, the long hair, you know, the Beatles, Bob Dylan, ecology were all sold as one package, you know. And I remember the first time I questioned that whole thing was I was in New York City, I think at K-Rock, and some Rainforest Coalition, I'm not sure the exact name, had a PSA they wanted me to do.
Yep.
And they would go to celebrities and just say, you know, we were on Broadway and stuff.
And they're raising money to save the rainforest.
Yeah, let me finish. Let's do this PSA. And I took the PSA, you know, 30-second public service announcement, and I looked at it, and the math in it was wrong. Not the facts, but the math of we're destroying this much rainforest this amount of time. And I multiplied it out, and it was off by a factor of 10 that I was going to read. And I was there with one of the guys who was a big cheese in the organization who was getting all the celebrities to read this. And I said to him, well, the math is off here. And he said, that doesn't matter. It's an idea we're pushing. The numbers don't matter. And that was the complete start of me going, I got to look into this, all this stuff I've taken for granted. It was amazing. I want to talk about nuclear power, something that a lot of people have flip-flopped on many times, and there's a lot of information about. We'll do that after the break. We're on Free FM, sitting here with Patrick Moore. I got Michael Goudeau, and my name is Penn Jillette. We'll be back right after this. That's Neil Maxa doing the trombone solo on that with the Mike Jones humongous orchestra playing the Penn Jillette theme. PennRadio.com, PennRadio.com. You'll get links to all the Mike Jones jazz stuff, and also you can send a Gmail directly to us because I think there's people that have things to say about the stuff we're talking about with Patrick Moore. We weren't quite finished with the rainforest stuff and so on, but I still want to jump to this. We were sure we'd get to it. You know, I'm from Greenfield, Massachusetts, and my brother-in-law, Ed worked at, he had the Homer Simpson job. He was a maintenance guy at Yankee Atomic Plant in Vermont, I think.
Vermont Yankee, yeah.
Yeah, Vermont Yankee. And he worked there, and I got he was able to give me a tour where I got to go and wear the little badge to see how much radiation I got as a kid. And I was really interested in the science. And although he was a maintenance man, he was very knowledgeable in science and loved talking about it and everything. But he had really short hair. He had a crew cut, you know, in 1970. So as I started to grow my hair, listen to rock and roll, the whole thing, nuclear power, became to me a guy with a crew cut that really didn't get it.
Yeah.
And then I don't know what year the No Nukes concert was. Do you know? The Bruce Springsteen, the Clash. I mean, really everybody cool in the world. Everybody that I love.
Jackson Brown.
Jackson Brown.
Yeah,
did
Bonnie
Raitt.
Huge
No Nukes thing.
Exactly.
And it took me until No Nukes to realize that I was just swept up in a culture that was actually, it was the culture that I was embracing, and I was embracing the culture on a scientific issue. And it occurred to me that the few people I read that actually had science backgrounds were disagreeing with the No Nukes people, or I should say were for nuclear power.
Yes.
And the people that were against nuclear power were people like Bruce Springsteen and Jackson Brown.
Guitar players.
seemed ludicrous, and I was getting my scientific information from people who played guitar. So it was a real change for me. Did you? Now, you started out thinking about, as you said, nuclear war. But
yes, and we just saw all things nuclear as part of the Holocaust potentially, you know. And I have to admit, I bought in to the anti-nuclear movement on the issue of safety, which in retrospect, the nuclear industry is one of the safest industries that's ever been created. If you look at the actual stats of people, and when you recognize that Chernobyl was actually an exception, in a way, the one that proves the rule that nuclear is generally safe, and you look at Three Mile Island, it was actually a success story from the point of view
of
being a serious internal accident in the reactor, like a partial meltdown of the core. Not much worse can happen. It was a big economic mistake, but it didn't hurt anybody. The containment vessel worked, and that's what the engineers designed it to do. So I would much rather have a bunch of engineers with crew cuts who do not smoke dope on the job, right? Looking after my nuclear power plants than I would have a bunch of guitar-playing hippies.
Well, you know, the thing that a friend of mine who is very pro-nuclear power said that after Three Mile Island, some people were killed by Three Mile Island, because that reactor being taken offline meant we used more coal power and people mining coal actually.
Good argument. And do most people know that coal-fired power plants emit hundreds of times more radiation than nuclear power plants do, because there's radon in the emissions from coal-fired power plants? As a matter of fact, before we understood it very well, thousands of coal miners died from radioactivity exposure in the mines because of the radon gas that's down there. Same thing that happened to the uranium miners in the early years. So uranium mining and coal mining had that thing in common, that deep underground in those deposits, there's radon gas that gives people cancer.
Now, I want to talk about this. Do you think, I mean, I have some friends in the sciences, just totally sciences, who blame scientists completely for this whole global warming problem, because when they knew nuclear power was a really good, clean, safe choice, they let the hippies and the rock musicians grab all the media and do all that, and the scientists just thought that the facts would speak for themselves and kept kind of quiet.
Yeah, the
and
trouble
he
is
blames them for that.
Yeah, but crew cut conservative engineers are not generally good communicators. It's the same problem with many people in the primary industries, whether it's forestry or agriculture or fishing or energy, is that the people who gravitate towards those industries are not generally communicators. They're not generally the Madison Avenue type.
It's not Jane Fonda and Jack Lemmon.
Precisely. they're not entertainers, right? And entertainers are so good at communicating.
Why do you think that is? I mean, Teller and I are libertarians, and we're very, very pro-science. I consider myself a cheerleader for science. You know, I said if I was smarter, I would have been in the sciences, but I went into show business. And when you are, I mean, Matt and Trey of South Park are also pro-science. But when you go to Hollywood, if you are not a very strong socialist, anti-science person, if you don't have that Sting, Jane Fonda sensibility, do you have any sort of guess as to why there are so few entertainers that are, for instance, for
I think that's why
power?
Paul Newman and Joanne Woodward moved out of Hollywood, is because they couldn't stand that atmosphere.
Uh-huh.
But it's rife. I mean, Woody Harrelson and Stone, what's his name?
Oliver Stone.
Oliver Stone and that whole crowd, Chevy Chase. These guys are wing nuts when it comes to science and the misinformation that they spread. Well, because they, I don't know what it is. These are the millionaire socialists. And, you know, yeah. And I don't know any better way to describe them. They're filthy rich themselves, and yet they think that it's somehow romantic to be living in squalor in a left-wing dictatorship. You know, I don't get it.
What I always thought about with perhaps this is Shirley MacLaine was on Letterman or something talking about how she believed in past lives and all this
the spirit
other
world and
anti-science
yeah.
stuff. And I thought that part of it just struck me listening to her that part of her motive was that if you want to debate in real science, you have to really do your homework. You know, but if you want to say that you're going with your heart and just what seems right and all of that kind of stuff, you are on a par with Einstein. And I use Einstein as an example because she was just debating Einstein, essentially, saying, well, he may say that the speed of light is, scientists may say that the speed of light
That's
is
right,
absolute.
But I've gone faster than that in my dreams.
I feel it.
Yeah.
And you can't deny what I feel. And I wonder, it just seems like another weird bounce, and Hollywood could have been pro-science, but I guess not. I guess it has to be in that direction.
Let's put it this way. There's 103 nuclear reactors operating every day in the United States, quietly delivering 20% of the electricity in this country. Now, that's even though they were stopped dead in their tracks in 1978, 79 because of Three Mile Island mm-hmm. and because of the incredible regulatory burden that was placed on nuclear plants at that time, which is one of the activists' main tactics, is if they don't like something, they put up a huge regulatory burden, so it becomes uneconomical to do it anymore. Mm-hmm. They've done that with genetically modified foods. It's no longer economical to do research on any of the smaller crops like peas and carrots, right? It's only economical to do it on soybeans and corn and potatoes and rice. Not even rice, it's not really economical because most rice is used in the country that grows it. There isn't much of an export-import market in rice. And so they've stopped genetic engineering in its tracks in many cases with huge regulatory overload that is totally unnecessary. The same thing happened to nuclear. But there hasn't been a nuclear plant ordered in the United States since Three Mile Island in 1979. And yet it's still delivering 20% of America's energy. If we had kept building nuclear reactors like France has, where they have 80% of their electricity from nuclear and the other 20 almost all from hydroelectric, which is also clean and non-greenhouse gas emitting, France has basically got the least pollution, least greenhouse gas electrical system in the world. And it's safe and operates at a reasonable cost every day of the year. Now, these 103 nuclear plants that are operating in the U.S., if they had to be replaced with coal-fired plants, that would be the equivalent of putting 100 million more cars on the road. And the existing 600-plus coal-fired plants in the United States, which are producing 60% of America's electricity, are the equivalent of 300 million automobiles on the road. That's the numbers we're working with. That's why when people look at greenhouse gas emissions and what can we do to reduce them, coal-fired power plants in the United States are 10% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions.
Now, if we were able to
That's
go...
why it's the low-hanging fruit, and we know how to replace it. We replace it with nuclear. Hydro is pretty well built out. And there, you know, the big myth is that we can solve this problem with windmills and solar panels. The fact of the matter is base load electricity, which is the main energy source, has to be always on. You cannot have an unreliable intermittent source of energy like solar and wind to run the base load. And the base load can only come from three things: fossil fuels, mainly coal, a little bit of oil, and some natural gas. But natural gas's price has gone out of the roof and is not good for base load anymore. It's only good for peaking. So you've got coal, really, as your natural gas. Then you've got hydroelectric. That's pretty well built out in North America. Canada is the number one hydro producer in the world. The United States is number two. Russia's number three. Then you have nuclear. Those are the only three baseload power sources: coal, hydro, nuclear. If you want to get rid of coal, nuclear is the only viable technical option that's cost-effective that we know of today, and it's proven to be safe and reliable And that's why I think we need to move off coal onto nuclear. And it's not only the greenhouse gas emissions. Coal is the biggest emitter of sulfur dioxide, of mercury, and of NOx, N-O-X, in the whole United States. It causes respiratory disease, it causes acid rain, and it causes mercury contamination to have all these coal-fired power plants emitting every day, along with the greenhouse gas threat and the concern about climate change.
I want to talk a lot more about, boy, there's so much to talk about. This is Patrick Moore we have on, one of the founders of Greenpeace, who's still an environmentalist, but also pro-nuclear power. I want to talk a lot more about this. This is penradio.com, penradio@gmail.com. This is Penn Jillette, same with Michael Goudeau, and we're mostly listening to Patrick Moore because he's got a lot to say. We'll be back right after this. That's Jimmy McIntosh playing the guitar solo on the Penn Jillette theme, Jimmy Mac, and with Mike Jones, big orchestra. And I'm playing bass on that. My name is Penn Jillette, and I'm sitting here with Michael Goudeau and Patrick Moore, who I'm not going to go to anything else. I want to go right back to Patrick Moore. We were talking during the break about nuclear waste. And I think you can just pretty much repeat what you were saying. Well, I have a friend who says that about uranium and the dangers of nuclear power, that he always says to the people who are anti-nuclear, he says, I'll start eating uranium, you start eating caffeine, gram for gram, we'll see who's standing. And what about the nuclear waste that the plants put out?
Well, unfortunately, the waste that comes out isn't just uranium.
Right.
The fuel that goes in, the uranium that goes in, is relatively innocuous. You can hold that in your hand without any concern. It is radioactive, but only mildly so. But the fission products that are created in the reactor when the uranium is split in the fission reaction, many of them are highly dangerous and very radioactive. The good thing is that the fission products themselves do not last a long time. About 50 years after you take the waste out of the reactor and have contained it for that time, it only contains about 1/1000th of the radiation that it did when it came out of the reactor. And most of the long-lived elements in the waste, plutonium, some of the uranium, and other transuranic elements, or actinides as they're called, the heavy elements, those have very, very long half-lives. They're not terribly radioactive, but they last for, in some cases, hundreds of thousands of years. That's a good thing because they are all useful as fuel again. And one of the things that most people didn't catch when the Energy Act passed last year with bipartisan support was that the United States has now lifted the ban on recycling or reprocessing spent nuclear fuel, what the anti-nuclear people always call nuclear waste. But in fact, it isn't waste. 95% of the energy that was in the fuel when it was first put in the reactor is still contained in that used fuel, but it needs to be recycled.
You're going to be very close to perpetual motion here, aren't you?
Very close, yes, because in fact, the amount of energy in a piece of uranium the size of the tip of your little finger is equivalent to tons of coal, many tons of coal.
Well, I have a really big little finger.
Yeah, that's many, many tons of coal. But the truth of the matter is that the waste problem can be easily resolved technically. The problem with nuclear waste is it's used as a political issue. And, you know, you can put nuclear waste on a train and take it from a nuclear reactor to a repository without any difficulty because they put it in a container that if you dropped it from 30,000 feet, it wouldn't break. They ram them into concrete walls at 100 miles an hour and they don't break. So the stuff can't get out. The trouble is the people lay down on the tracks and stop the train. That's a political problem.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have to, in analyzing the issues around nuclear, we really have to sort out the politics from the technology.
One of the things that drives me crazy is in all these arguments, it seems like they compare the dangers of nuclear to nothing. They don't ever compare the way adults make decisions, which is to say, we need to have energy. Let's look at nuclear, let's look at solar, let's look at wind, let's look at coal, and let's look at all the pluses and minuses.
Exactly.
They never seem to do that. They always seem to say, these are the dangers of nuclear compared to nothing. We don't have nothing. There's no way we're going to have no energy use whatsoever.
And there's no way we're going to have no risk ever.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. So you have to have risk in order to have that. It just seems like the. Do you think we can get from where we are now? And I know nothing breaks my heart more than having to say something good about France. But do you think we can get power-wise from where we are now to where France is with 80% nuclear in any sort of reasonable amount of time?
It'll take a while. Their cheese is pretty good, too. You know?
You're absolutely right. And they invented the kiss and another sexual act that I'm all for.
And there are people against both of those.
But different people.
Yes, different people.
Speaking of different people, one of the amazing things about this whole nuclear discussion and the climate change issue is I've had over 400 email responses to my Washington Post editorial that I wrote a few weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And those make it very clear that, number one, waste is the key issue.
Uh-huh.
But number two, people who are against nuclear energy are also the ones who are most concerned about climate change and fossil fuel consumption. And secondly, the people who are for nuclear energy, many of those don't believe in the climate change scenario. They are deniers, right? And it's extremely difficult to break through that politic.
You know, I want to talk about the global warming thing, you know, because I'm a juggler. I'm a magician, you know. I try to read when I can, but I don't know Jack, you know. And the global warming thing, although my hardcore science friends tell me it's real, all the people talking about it, it seems like jive. The rhetoric of it seems like nonsense. It seems really like the same kind of hidden agenda stuff you see with the anti-globalization and the anti-genetically modified food. So it really bothers me because I think that you have to accept that global warming is happening and you have to accept that it's anthropogenic. But all the people talking about it really, really bug me. That's exactly what you're...
But you don't have to accept that it's 100% bad, even if it is warming and even if we are doing it. Well, we know it's warming right now, but there was a period between 1940 and 1980 where it cooled off for 40 years. Mm-hmm. And everybody says that was particulate... Well, all the climate change people say that that was particulate matter. Mm-hmm. Now there's a big deal about dimming. I don't know if you've heard about global dimming, but it's basically the fact that maybe it's a good thing we have all these coal-fired power plants putting all this particulate matter into the air, not the greenhouse gases, but the particulates, because that is reducing the amount of sun that's reaching the Earth and reducing the global warming that would happen if we didn't have all that particulate in the air. It's become so complicated. There's so much snake oil around the whole subject. The best comment that was ever made was by Michael Crichton in his book State of Fear. He said, "I am certain there is too much certainty in the world." And I am certain that he is right, because all of these people who pontificate away as if they know all the answers, climate change is, in fact, the most difficult issue facing the scientific community today in terms of being able to actually predict with any kind of accuracy what's going to happen.
I want to make this clear. You mean difficult in terms of doing the science.
Yes.
You do not mean in terms of politics or fixing it or moving ahead, but just knowing what the hell's happening, right?
Exactly. We know that we are the cause of the increased CO2 in the atmosphere with our fossil fuel consumption. Mm-hmm. We know that for a fact. We also know that right now, since 1980, we're in a warming trend. We cannot prove in scientific fact, like with the QED at the end, you know, we cannot prove that it's our CO2 emissions that are causing the present warming trend. We can surmise, and you know they talk about an overwhelming consensus among scientists on this subject. Consensus is not a science word. Consensus is a political word, or at least it's a social word. It isn't a science word. There's no word consensus in the science literature.
That may be one of the smartest sentences I've ever heard. I just take that consensus word with scientists. I never even noticed that. But of course, that's exactly right. Reminds me of my favorite stories about Einstein, who was walking some red carpet somewhere where press were around him, and a few press people said, "You know they're putting out a book that is called 100 Scientists Prove Einstein Wrong." And Einstein responded, "One. It takes one."
Exactly.
and consensus means nothing.
A majority of scientists have been wrong many, many times in the history of the world and the history of science. Mm-hmm. I mean, Galileo was one.
Well,
Copernicus was one.
in the 60s, weren't we terrified that the world was getting colder from what we did?
It was.
Yeah.
I remember back when I'm from, you know, Canada, so I remember
it's really cold.
The winters were really severe during the 60s. Uh-huh. And now we haven't had a hard frost for 10 years in Vancouver.
Well, that's the kind of argument that makes me insane. I mean, was it Al Gore did that editorial or the op-ed piece in the New York Times, years ago that talked about New York City's really hot this summer and people still deny global warming?
Yes.
I mean, we're talking about micro degrees in global warming. We're not talking about Al Gore sweating on the streets of New York City.
They confuse weather with climate, and mm-hmm. it's an easy thing to confuse people with. In the same way that they're now going on about how these hurricanes are more severe because of global warming. Well, actually, theory would have you believe that the hurricanes would become less severe under certain scenarios of global warming. We should get, you know, then they're saying that the whole world is going to go into a drought and become a desert with global warming, when actually, when it gets warmer, more water evaporates off the sea. You'd actually think there would be more rainfall in a globally warmed world. And in fact, if you go back into periods in history when the Earth was much warmer than it is today, people forget that we're in an ice age right now. This is an interglacial period. It's a little bit warmer than it was 100,000 years ago, but not much. Whereas if you go back millions of years, you'll find long periods in the Earth's history when there was no ice at either pole and when all the forests were subtropical and tropical right to the Arctic Circle. And that's in history. It's a fact. So the Earth is actually relatively cool now. We're about 14 degrees global average temperature Celsius right now. It's been 22 at times for long, long periods. Like I'm talking tens of millions of years, when life flourished, and the carbon was laid down for the coal deposits and all that.
Part of all of this is just people trying to feel more important. I mean, this idea that we have to save the Earth, we just don't have that much power over that. And also, people love to pretend they're living in the end times because it gives you more power.
The end is nigh has been there since the beginning,
right? Of course, yeah. You know? I mean, there's two things that seem to always be true. One is the world keeps getting better for people, and two, people always think it's getting worse. And there's some sort of sociological reason for that.
Except we have converted about a third of the Earth's surface from what it was, although it's been changing throughout history as mm-hmm. well. But we are the agent of change.
On a third of the surface?
Of the forested part.
Okay, that's
yeah,
a, okay.
Of the places where you can grow things, and not uh-huh. counting the desert. Of the green part of the Earth, we've converted about a third of it into our own agricultural and forestry uses. Mm-hmm. We have made a huge impact on carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere. Nothing compared to what has happened historically. Like, we have nearly 400 parts per million CO2 in the atmosphere now, compared to 260 to 280 at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. Mm-hmm. There's been times in Earth's history, the Eocene thermal maximum 50 million years ago, there was 2,000 to 3,000 parts per million CO2 in the atmosphere then. So we're not doing anything that is anywhere near outside the bounds of what has happened through natural occurrences. And as a matter of fact, we are a natural occurrence. And one of my arguments with James Lovelock, the father of the Gaia theory, who I greatly admire, he is a world foremost climate scientist and atmospheric chemist. But he thinks that we are causing Armageddon and catastrophic climate change, and it's going to happen in this century, and we're all going to die. And he's become a real alarmist, along with many others in the climate change community. And I said, James, your theory is that all of life is acting in kind of concert to control the chemistry of the atmosphere to make it more comfortable for us to be here. We are part of Gaia. Human beings are part of Gaia. What's to say that Gaia isn't using us to pump this carbon dioxide into the atmosphere to jumpstart us out of these ice ages, which cover half the planet in ice every 100,000 years, which is not a good thing for living creatures. Maybe Gaia wants to go back to a warmer climate and get out of this ice age thing. You see, so there's so many different ways of looking at this, is why I say that it is the greatest challenge for science today.
But maybe Gaia doesn't want anything. Maybe there is no Gaia. Maybe it's just people trying to take care of the world around them and each other. You know, maybe there's just that, too.
That's way too logical.
we have Patrick Moore here, one of my true heroes. PennRadio@gmail.com if you want to write a Gmail. This is Penn Jillette and Michael Godeau saying it's so likely that the world will still be here for us to be able to do another show. That just seems overwhelmingly likely. Go Nukes! This is Penn Jillette. Bye-bye.
Check out Penn Jillette weekdays from 2 to 3 on Free FM.